This is KBOO's The Voice of the Middle East. صوت الشرق الاوسط من اذاعه كيبل و صدای خبر میانه از رادیو KBOO.
طلق بابنا طلونا السيارات بين ربوعنا خلونا نحكي السهرات جوالي وطلق بابنا طلونا السيارات وبين ربوعنا فيات غنينا وعلى مياه غنينا على أقصى ما حلو من زهد الطير الشال نحن حكايات في بال مننا المال
Good evening and welcome to another installment of The Voices of the Middle East. This is Gudar Zektedari, your host, and you're listening to KBOO on 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, and on the cyberspace at kboo.fm. Since our last program, the war has ended in the theater, the kind of the aftershock has started in Iraq. But we're not done with Iraq or with Afghanistan yet. The new targets are now being introduced to the public. Both right after the collapse of Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, there were discussion of Syria becoming on top of the list. As you know, Syria was not part of the Axis of Evil as it was introduced in January of 2001, but 2002, I apologize. But apparently it's speeding up and getting to the first step. Discussions and disagreement between Pentagon and the State Department over Syria and criticism of Secretary Colin Powell by Newt Gingrich and the other activists in American Enterprise Institute, they all show that they are not satisfied with the way State Department is trying to work diplomacy over the problems in the Middle East, and they rather go with force and with military operation. This week, American Enterprise Institute had another seminar, and the speakers, the whole day, they talked about Iran as the next target. And as you know, this has been discussed in the past, and it is one of the wills and wishes of Israeli government and Ariel Sharon to continue the fight after Baghdad to Tehran, because they believe that Iran is the most dangerous element in the region, and a peace initiative in the Middle East would not succeed if a theocratic regime in Iran exists. So the program for regime change now is going to Iran, and the American Enterprise Institute had several speakers that day, including an advisor to Israel Defense Ministry, who spoke to these issues. The other speaker was Senator Sam Brownback, who is the Republican right-wing senator of Arkansas. And strange enough and surprisingly, he announced that he and Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon are introducing a bill, Senate Resolution 82, that would ask the government of the United States to dedicate $50 million a year for developing a strategy to bring democracy to Iran. And one of the conditions is not to negotiate anything with anybody within the country, but also try to promote elements from outside the country, including some satellite TV stations in Southern California who are broadcasting over Iran. And the day after after that meeting, Senator Brownback And one of the speakers of that seminar, Mr. Rob Sobhani, who is a TV personality on Fox TV every night, and he talks about Iran and gives all the promises. And he's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. They announced the establishment of a new organization called Democracy for Iran, Center for Democracy in Iran. And they are planning in pursuing this project. Because of that, tonight I have thought it would be a good idea to talk about the issue of Iran and do a little flashback to approximately 50 years ago. In August of 1953, an operation under the tag name of Ajax, TP Ajax, was in making at these times 50 years ago. And CIA basically staged a whole operation, worked on it for at least a couple of years to bring it into production. And with me tonight is one of the rare scholars who have done extensive studies and research on this issue, Professor Mark Gazirovsky, who teaches at Louisiana State University, had done, since 60s, when he wrote his dissertation on the coup of 1953 in Iran, and you probably, audience, have heard about this operation, and this is the beginning of a series of external covert operation to regime change back in 50s and 60s in around the world, in Iran, in Iraq, in Guatemala, and later in 70s in Chile. So I have the pleasure to talk to Professor Gazirovsky. He's a Oxford scholar and have traveled to Iran several times and have taught. Actually, he has taught at Tehran University recently. Dr. Gazirovsky, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Would you please maybe start with how did you become interested in this event to begin with?
Well, I first became interested in Iran when I started graduate school in 1978. And, of course, the Iranian Revolution was occurring then, and it had a very anti-American character. And so, having been a child of the 1960s myself, I was very interested in why Iranians were so anti-American. And the more I read into it, the more I realized that the 1953 coup was an important part of that story. And so I eventually wrote my PhD dissertation on the coup and on subsequent U.S. intervention in Iranian politics.
Can you give us a little background of, how it basically get to the point that the U.S. Desired to have that kind of operation? Before that, apparently U.S. was trying to be neutral in the conflict between Iranian national regime and the British oil industry, which basically they had all these difficulties.
Well, the United States had been quite favorable toward Iran for a long time. Of course, Iran was strategically very important at this time, located on the southern border of the Soviet Union. There had been a big crisis in 1945 and 1946 when the Soviet Union tried to basically take over much of northwestern Iran. This had been an important early battle in the U.S.-Soviet Cold War. And so dating from that time, the U.S. had been very interested in Iran. And U.S. officials very much recognized that part of the problem in Iran was that the government was very weak because it was, basically very unpopular and dictatorial. And so when Mohammad Mossadegh became prime minister in 1951, U.S. officials very well understood that he was a very different kind of leader, that he was a positive, progressive, moderate figure. And they looked upon him, when he was first appointed prime minister, as you know, almost an ideal kind of leader for the Middle East, a progressive figure who would be popular, but also someone who was moderate and pro-Western. And so at first the U.S. was very positive about Mossadegh, and even though Mossadegh had nationalized the British oil industry, U.S. officials didn't see that in particularly negative light. I mean, after all, the United States had been born out of an anti-British revolution itself, so there was a fair amount of sympathy for that. And for the first year and a half or so that Mossadegh was in power, the United States was supportive toward him, gave him a certain amount of aid, and tried very hard to resolve the oil crisis between Iran and Britain. But as time wore on, that oil crisis wasn't solved. U.S. officials increasingly began to have the belief that Mossadegh was being intransigent, and particularly after the events of the summer of 1952, the period Siyat Tir, 30th of Tir, when another prime minister briefly came into power and then was swept away in a massive uprising by pro-Mossadegh forces. After that, U.S. officials began to feel that Mossadegh was becoming too dependent on the Iranian Communist Party and was losing some of his popular support, particularly as popular figures like Ayatollah Khashoggi and others defected and broke with him and went into the opposition. And so by the fall of 1952, U.S. officials were getting quite worried about Mossadegh. But still, as long as President Truman was in power until January 1953, they were supportive and they were trying to solve the oil crisis, but they were becoming increasingly concerned. It was really after the Eisenhower administration came into office in January 1953 that a very different view emerged. The Eisenhower administration, not unlike the Bush administration today, had a very different agenda, much more aggressive, much more interventionist, much more of an attitude and an agenda to follow. And they saw Iran as an important test case. They wanted to roll back the Iron Curtain and act very aggressively against the Soviet Union. They had the idea, which was not really very well grounded in reality, but they had the idea anyway, that the Communist Party was very powerful. And so they very quickly took the initial steps to begin the coup. And what was really the turning point came in March 1953 when Mossadegh rejected the last of the U.S. efforts to resolve the oil crisis. And that was really the turning point. And it's very clear that within a week or two after Mossadegh rejected that U.S. officials decided to go, you know, full scale in favor of a coup, and then things just moved forward from there.
Before we talk about the operation itself, I know you are writing a book about Dr. Mossadegh, and as you mentioned, he was one of the very first, I guess he's the only democratically elected prime minister during the Shah and after constitutional movement of the 19th century in Iran. Could you please give us a little, talk about Dr. Mossadegh himself and what kind of system of government was actually happening at that time during the, it was right after the World War II.
Yeah. Well, he was a very interesting figure. He was from an aristocratic family, was a very wealthy man, but he was also very highly educated. He was one of pretty much the first generation of Iranians to go and study in Europe. He studied law. He had been a political figure in Iran since the early 1920s, after he came back from Europe. Had been a lifelong opponent of the Pahlavi dynasty, both the first Pahlavi and the second Pahlavi, who was king at the time that he was prime minister. He was out of politics for a long time. He was pushed aside by the Shah's father. He came back into politics at the very end of World War II. There emerged in that period a movement to nationalize the oil industry, which at that time was owned and operated by the British, by the predecessor to British Petroleum. And so he became the leader of this movement in the late 1940s. But he really saw it as a movement that had two goals. One was to nationalize the oil industry and to regain, you know, Iranian control over its own economy. But second, he saw as intertwined with that, that his movement was to bring democracy to Iran, to end the domination that had been going on for quite some time of, you know, basically the landed oligarchy, which was very pro-British. Since the landed oligarchy was very closely tied to the British, he felt that these were two sides of the same street. struggle, bringing democracy to Iran and getting British control out of the Iranian economy. And so, you know, he led the oil movement. He was a member of the parliament. He eventually, you know, when the movement really culminated, when there was no alternative, the Shah realized that he had to appoint Mossadegh prime minister. This was in late April 1951. Immediately then, Mossadegh nationalized the oil industry and you know, began his efforts to transform Iran on these two levels that I've talked about. So he really was an extremely positive figure in Iran, and you know, one that anybody who has a progressive attitude would look favorably upon. The one thing that I would say, though, was that he was very obstinate. He was not very pragmatic. He was very much of an idealist, and I think that he really misunderstood the nature of world conditions at that time and Iran's role in that. And you know, in my view, he really waited too long. I think if he had solved the oil crisis earlier, if he had reached an agreement with the British, things would have turned out very, very differently in Iran and much, much better for Iran. So although he was a great figure in many respects, I think that also his obstinacy was an important part of the problem and was part of the reason that the United States eventually decided to do this.
So in other words, he was not pragmatic with
Yes, he was not a pragmatic figure. He did not, you know, carefully look at the situation around him and act accordingly. He just held out and held out and held out. He was really too much of an idealist, I think.
As far as a U.S. Intervention goes, was this a change in foreign policy for the United States, or was it a continuation of international foreign?
Well, it was really a very big change. The United States, well, first of all, the United States before World War II, of course, had been very isolationist, or that is to say outside of the Western Hemisphere, had been very uninvolved. The United States had not really been involved at all in the Middle East before World War II. After World War II, the United States did, you know, move onto the global stage and get more involved in Europe and Asia and elsewhere. But initially, the U.S. was doing that in a relatively innocent way, I would say, and specifically the CIA, which was created only after World War II, although it did engage in some covert action in Europe in the late 1940s, trying to undermine the communist parties in France and Italy and trying to destabilize the Soviet bloc countries. That being said, it had never done anything like the 1953 coup in Iran. It had never undertaken actions that were hostile toward a pro-Western leader, and certainly it had never tried to overthrow a government in this kind of massive way that it did. So this really was a dramatic change. It was really the first big operation outside of Europe that the CIA undertook. It was the first time the CIA tried to overthrow a government. It was really a massive operation, and it was, you know, subsequently seen that way. It was the model for subsequent U.S. coup attempts, as you mentioned earlier, in Guatemala, in Syria, in Iraq, in Chile, and probably in other places. Well, so this really was a big, important turning point in U.S. foreign policy.
Could you talk to the operation itself, and we will come back and discuss more about what really brought Dr. Mossadegh to that position, because he had lots of sympathy to the United States at the beginning when he came to power, and as you mentioned, he was a Western educated, he was a graduate from Sorbonne, I guess, and he had pretty good, I guess, attitude toward West, but finally got really into this situation. And documents and, I guess, the historian reports on the operation was classified until, and it is, I guess, part of it is still classified until last couple of years, when New York Times published the history by written by Donald Wilbur. Could you speak to those as well?
Do you want me to describe the operation or the document?
Yeah, well, maybe we'll start with document, how it was declassified.
Yeah, well, there have been two main sources, really three main sources of information about the coup itself. The first really was the head of the coup operation, Kermit Roosevelt, who was the grandson of U.S. President Teddy Roosevelt and who was the head of Middle East covert operations at the time. He published a memoir of the coup, which came out in the fall of 1979, just a couple of weeks before the U.S. embassy was taken in Iran. And he described in considerable detail the coup, although he made various mistakes and wasn't entirely clear about things. So that came out and really revealed quite clearly that the U.S. had been involved and what it all consisted of. Then, secondly, in the 1980s, I was able to interview almost all of the CIA officers who were involved, as well as some British officials and even a few Iranians who were involved in one way or another. And so I got a lot of additional information from those sources. And then finally, it just happened that this was 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I think two, 3 years ago time. Now, the New York Times somehow got hold of a 200-page internal study that the CIA had commissioned a year or so after the coup, which was a detailed overview of the coup. This was written by Donald Wilbur, who was an adjunct professor at Princeton and a part-time CIA employee. He's an architectural historian, very famous figure, scholar of Iran who died a few years ago. He had been the main planner of the coup, which I'll talk about in a few minutes if you like. And so then after the coup, he was commissioned to write, the official history of it. And this was meant to be sort of a document that the CIA would have, which would be kind of like a blueprint for future coups or, an official history that could be referred back to when CIA was planning coups elsewhere. And so anyway, that document somehow was obtained by the CIA. It's not clear by the New York Times. It's not clear how the New York Times got it. But in any case, they got hold of it, the full copy. And then after talking to myself and a few other people, they decided that they would blank out most of the names. Mm-hmm. But, other than that, they published the full thing on their website about 3 years ago. And then they made a mistake, actually, in the way they published it. So various people, including myself, were able to obtain most of the names that had been blanked out. So, most of the details came out. So those are the sources of information, and all in all, they give you a very detailed overview of how the coup occurred. There isn't really too much that is left unknown, although there is a little bit, mainly about which Iranians were involved in certain crucial details. Mm-hmm. But on the American side, it's all very clear now how it all happened.
And I have a page on this program website, www.voicesofthemiddleeast.org. One word, Voices of the Middle East, and there is a Lessons of History page, and all the documents, the New York Times link. In addition to that, there is a paper that Professor Kazirovsky has written about it, are there, and if audience wants to log into and read more about it, they can. So, Mark, would you please now go to the operation itself and how it happened?
Okay.
And I guess for those who don't have really much of probably background on contemporary history of Iran, I would say that at this time there was a very strong labor movement in Iran under Tudeh Party, which was one of the brother left parties of the world, and this is kind of a high rise of Soviet Union. And they had they were very influential on Tudeh Party. And Iran, obviously, was in the southern border of Soviet Union and north of Persian Gulf. And obviously, Soviets had lots of interest in that country as much as Americans had to keep the buffer between Soviet Union and, as they were called at those times, the warm waters. And I guess, building on that situation, the religiosity of the people and their fear of communism, I think that played a role in U.S. operative being able to create the background for the coup.